Southwest Airlines to give refunds on a lot of these flights, and there's always some contention here whether these were weather related. I think it's pretty clear that after the first day or two, it wasn't weather related. But the industry is very wary of additional regulation, and that's what the Biden administration has brought and has threatened over the last year or so since coming out of the pandemic. Those regulations add cost to customers and the airlines and lower the profit margins.
Now, what's the airline saying about how it intends to make things right for the hundreds of thousands of passengers affected?
It's really hard to make everything right at this point. A lot of people have had their holidays ruined, their vacations upended. They've promised to reimburse reasonable expenses for rental cars, for getting flights on other airlines, for hotels and things like that. But when you've lost a very important holiday season like this, and you just can't get it back.
Yeah, you can't really get back memories that you missed, huh? Kyle Arnold of the Dallas Morning News, thank you so much for all your time.
Thank you.
The pilots who fly millions of Southwest Airlines passengers each year say the waves of canceled flights over the past few days point to long-standing problems at the airline. So we're going to ask Casey Murray about this. He's an airline captain and president of the Southwest Airlines Pilot Association. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I mean, I guess I want to start, Casey, with whether you were surprised that this level of a disruption happened at Southwest when the storm came.
No, I absolutely wasn't surprised. I don't think most of our pilots were surprised. This has been an ongoing issue for Southwest for really quite a few years. And the last 20 months, these meltdowns have seemed to occur. They've been coming with more frequency and they've becoming more severe. What happened over the Christmas weekend is really catastrophic.
Now, your union has been sounding the alarm about this problem and about a lack of investment, especially when it comes to technical advances, for years. Why weren't they addressed?
Well, I think that's a question for Southwest. But on our end, we've seen an increasing amount of inefficiency of how crews are being used. Southwest is having really some major issues connecting pilots to airplanes, connecting crews, flight attendants as well, to airplanes. And it's been getting worse. And it's a function, as Kyle just said, of infrastructure and IT, but it's also processes. We're still using not only IT from the 90s, but also processes when our airline was a tenth of the size. And it's really just not scaled for an operation that we have today.
So when you have this level of cancellations, you can't link the crew and the pilots to the planes?
That's correct. And the inefficiencies then, well, inefficiencies is the best word, because crews get out of position, they have to start deadheading around. And 14 months ago, we had a major meltdown over Columbus Day. And it started with a summer kind of, you know, simple thunderstorm in Florida. And it cascaded to where by the end of the 3 days, we had 1,200 pilots who were at work, but never touched the wheel of an airplane, meaning they were either lost in hotels or deadheading around the system. And you just can't operate like that.
Let's talk about what happened this weekend and what's still happening. This turmoil is still going on. How has it affected your fellow pilots, other airline workers? What were they going through? I mean, we heard a lot about what the passengers were going through, but what was happening with employees?
Well, we really feel, you know, for our customers who are stranded, who lost memories, who lost, you know, they're out money. But the employees were kind of left to their own devices. Whether it was pilots, whether it was customer service agents, whether it was ramp agents, they weren't given the tools to do their job, nor were they given the leadership to answer the questions and to be able to provide solutions. And really, that's where we really failed, was not leading and not being able to give our employees the tools.
Does any of these problems with the processes and the tech issue, does that actually compromise safety of air travel?
Well, at the end of the day, our pilots do a great job of mitigating risk, and ultimately it falls on them. We have actually, as our pilots association, have done a written letter to, an open letter to our management just earlier this year about these exact issues, but how it's causing unprecedented amounts of fatigue in our pilots. And we've seen fatigue calls go through the roof and continue to increase. So, but that's part of the safety chain and breaking the air chain that causes accidents is our pilot's ability to make that call and go, listen, I am tired. You need to take me off this flight. So at the end of the day, our pilots are responsible for mitigating and stopping, you know, that risk. And I think we do a fine job. But that being said, it's putting more and more pressure on our crews, you know, to make those decisions and understand when they're tired and taking that out of the error chain.
The level of cancellations this weekend, especially with Southwest, have reignited conversation about holding airlines accountable. Have you sat down with anyone in the government to discuss what happened?
I did speak to Secretary Buttigieg yesterday, and we had a great conversation. We discussed, you know, the level and the chaos with this latest meltdown and kind of what we were seeing on our side. I was very pleased. He, you know, was very concerned, as I was, about our customers, but also we had a good conversation about what our employees faced and the challenges that were facing them as well.
We've reached out to Southwest Airlines for comment. As of this time, we have not heard back. Casey Murray is president of the Southwest Airlines Pilots Association. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Southwest Airlines. They declined to comment.
New attacks on electrical substations in the Pacific Northwest have raised concerns about a vulnerable power grid. Four sites in Washington State were broken into and damaged over the holiday weekend. John Ryan of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
On Christmas morning, Jim Dye woke up and noticed the lights wouldn't go on, and he had no water.
Oh, yeah. All the homes out here are all electric, and a lot of them are on wells, which mean they're electric pumps. So everybody was out of water and out of electric.
Dye was one of close to 15,000 customers who lost power after three substations in the Tacoma area were attacked before sunrise Christmas Day. A fourth substation was damaged and set on fire later that same day.
When you have four different stations and they were all targeted, that tells me that it was not just some kid throwing a bottle over the fence. So that's the part that bothers me.
It's unclear whether these crimes were coordinated or what the attackers' motives might be, says Darren Moss Jr. with the Pierce County Sheriff's Department.
At this point, we believe their goal was to shut down the power. The reasons for that, we don't know yet. We know about similar incidents in North Carolina, Southern Washington, and parts of Oregon.
Multiple federal agencies have been warning utilities of the risk of white supremacist attacks on the nation's electrical infrastructure. In February, three white supremacists from Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin pleaded guilty to federal crimes related to a plot to attack the power grid. Following an armed attack on a substation in North Carolina in December, federal energy officials ordered a review of security measures. The lights stay on in this country because of a system that includes more than 50,000 substations. Those scattered outposts are where high-voltage power is converted to the smaller voltages that come out of your power outlets. Ross Johnson is a grid security consultant.
If you were to protect every one of them to the highest level possible, it would make electricity extremely expensive.
Johnson says substations and power lines are often targeted by thieves looking to sell copper, but he says ordinary thievery has become less profitable thanks to improving surveillance technology and a shift to a type of copper that's harder to resell. Back in Pierce County, where the grid was attacked, Jim Dye says he salvaged Christmas dinner by cooking pork bellies outside on his charcoal grill. For NPR News, I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. Good morning. It's 8:19. I'm Alex Crow. It's Wednesday, and later this hour we have Wisconsin Life. Today's story focuses on a bipartisan group of political observers in La Crosse, which has been wagering on the outcome of elections for nearly 50 years. Maureen McCullum and John Davis bring you that story during Wisconsin Life. It's just 25 minutes away here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Earthquakes are rumbling through West Texas.
The activities are not shaking the ground. It's more changing the stresses that are acting on these faults. And those stresses, in turn, cause these faults to slip, which then cause the shaking.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Oil field shakeups, next time on Marketplace.
You can hear Marketplace tonight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered, on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center and the Alzheimer's Association offers a monthly memory cafe. It's held the second Tuesday of each month from 1 until 2 p.m. Call 800-272-3900.
Into Wisconsin today, high temperatures reaching the mid-30s in the north and upper 40s in the south, freezing rain expected overnight. Still warmer tomorrow, with highs ranging from the low 40s in the north to low 50s in the south. A wintry mix and rain expected across all the state as well. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, now sharing stories and solutions from the front lines of America's mental health crisis on the After the Fact podcast. Available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows, and more information, are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. These are stressful times in the former Soviet republics of Central Asia. Hundreds of thousands of Russians have arrived there in recent months to avoid being drafted to fight in the war in Ukraine. Some have already left. Many others are staying. NPR's Philip Reeves went to the capital of Uzbekistan, where he talked with Russian arrivals and their hosts.
It's a dark and snowy night in Tashkent, but there is a pocket of warmth. This is a bar where newly arrived Russians gather to swap stories and share tips about how to start a new life many hundreds of miles from home.
They don't know what to do, and this is truly a shock for them.
That's Aziz. He's asked NPR not to use his full name to avoid putting him in danger. For most of his life, he's lived in and around Moscow. He owns a coffee shop there. Now, though, he works here in this bar, mixing cocktails into the wee hours of the morning. Aziz's life changed overnight in September when President Vladimir Putin unveiled a plan to call up 300,000 reservists. Aziz and his family decided he had to leave Russia immediately. It was a difficult decision, says Aziz, switching to Russian. He left behind a fiancée, family, friends, and also, he says, the country he loves. Yet he's certain it was the right thing to do. I didn't want to participate in a contrived, senseless, and cruel war, he says. It's hard to establish precisely how many Russians have come to Uzbekistan. Their numbers fluctuate. Uzbek officials have said nearly 80,000 arrived in September alone. Russians are allowed in without a visa. Putin didn't try to prevent them leaving. From his viewpoint, that was the correct decision, says Uzbek economist Otabek Bakirov. Better to have them leave than go on the streets shouting down with Putin. The Russians have landed in a very different country to their own, a Muslim-majority nation, the most populous in Central Asia. Yet they share a painful history with it. Uzbekistan was part of the Soviet Union. Hundreds of thousands of Uzbeks were executed, jailed, or dispatched to labor camps, most during Stalin's rule. In another Tashkent bar, a bust of Stalin stands on a shelf. Russians and Uzbeks sit at the tables while people perform Russian classics from Soviet times. Many in Uzbekistan, especially among the elderly, feel nostalgic about the past. Many support Putin's war. Even so, Russians arriving here to escape that war told NPR that most people welcome them. Most, but not all.
I don't want to see them. I don't want to help them.
Journalist, playwright, and movie maker Nikita Makarenko is one of Uzbekistan's leading bloggers.
The whole problem is that they demand help. They literally demand help. Hey, we need your time, we need your cheap apartments, you need to help us to find jobs. Sorry, people, you need to help Ukrainians to win.
That issue about taking over apartments is certainly a sore point among Tashkent residents. Fatima Kushbakeva makes her living by delivering food to traders in the city's largest market. The influx of Russians has sent her rent soaring. It's gone up to $400 a month, she says. That's a 25% increase. There is one place where Russians are being welcomed with open arms. This is Tashkent's IT park. It's a cluster of sparkling high-rise buildings. The Uzbek government's creating a network of hubs like this in an effort to turn the country into a global IT center. There's a skills shortage. Russian IT specialists are snapped up and given fast-track relocation. Denis Mulin, who's 27, arrived 3 months ago from the Russian city of Kazan. He won't talk about the war, but makes no secret that he came here to avoid the draft. The hardest part was realizing that you just can't be where you want to be, he says. He works here as a project manager. He likes life here. The food's delicious, he says. Living's not too expensive. He's learning the language. And yet...
Are you missing home?
Yes. Yes.
He feels homesick all the time. I don't think that will ever go away, he says. On the streets outside, we meet another Russian. Margarita Gorichnia is from the Russian city of Tula. She, too, speaks of a warm welcome given to her and her husband. In 3 months, only two people have been unfriendly and called us deserters, she says. Russians moving here aren't all outright opponents of Putin. Gorichnia says she won't condemn Putin's government and that she doesn't understand the Ukrainians. They're Slavs like us. Why do they want to be separate, she says. Above all, she hates the war and misses home. Back among the Russians at the cocktail bar, Aziz also yearns for home. When he left Moscow, he wasn't sure he'd ever be able to return. He's rethinking that. He's heard of draft dodgers who've gone back without encountering problems. Yet Aziz says he's still worried that Russian authorities will come after him and send him off to what he sees as an entirely unjustifiable war. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Tashkent.
To keep up with the latest news from the conflict in Ukraine, go to NPR's podcast, State of Ukraine, where you can listen to the most recent stories about the war. That's State of Ukraine from NPR. Find it where you listen to your podcasts. This is NPR News.
Polarization affects all sorts of behavior, who you date, where you live, but some musicians see their work as a way to bridge that gap.
Music is especially, it's literally linked to our brain and to our hearts.
I'm Sarah McCammon. The role of music in a divided America, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning. It's 8:29. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crow. NPR headlines and WPR state news headlines, both on the way next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Emergency crews in western New York State continue to search for cars buried under mounds of snow after the blizzard over the weekend. Buffalo was especially hard hit. More than 4 feet of snow fell in some areas. The National Guard was called in to help enforce a driving ban. Nationwide, air travel remains challenging, especially for Southwest Airlines passengers. The carrier canceled 2,500 U.S. flights for today. The federal government is investigating why Southwest is having so much trouble. Tens of thousands of people in Oregon are without power today as the region endures heavy wind and rain. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
The power outages are spread across the western part of the state. People along the coastline and in the Portland metro region are coping without electricity. The National Weather Service has issued a high wind advisory for the region and warns that gusts could reach up to 75 miles per hour in some areas. The wind has already brought down trees and closed sections of roads and highways. Officials caution those living along the Oregon coast to be especially cautious, as breaker waves could reach 20 feet or higher. Those dangerous waves have been known to unexpectedly wash over beaches and sweep people off jetties or rocks. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Portland.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A newly approved state plan for Rib Mountain will allow Wisconsin's largest ski resort to significantly expand its footprint. The economic impact of the Granite Peak ski area outside of Wausau has been estimated at more than $27 million per year. After a years-long state review this month, the Natural Resources Board said the resort could lease an additional 100 acres of land for the expansion. The plan would also add mountain biking trails on the hill and create a hiking trail around the base of the mountain. Mike Repyak of the International Mountain Biking Association told the board that it's important that the plan include options for bikers and climbers of differing skill levels.
So we're not going to go out there and build trails that are just double black diamond trails, and it's only for a certain niche of riders, or super technical climbing trails for hikers, and it's only a certain fit folks that can go and hike those trails.
It could be years before those proposals are actually completed. The Dodge County Sheriff's Office is investigating after a body was found lying in a river. The man's body was found around 3:30 Tuesday afternoon. The Sheriff's Office says the 29-year-old man was dead when deputies arrived on scene. The body was found in the Rubicon River, just west of Highway 67 in Neosho. So far, the Dodge County Sheriff's Office says foul play is not expected, but a cause of death has not been determined. Sheriff Dale Schmidt is reminding people to exercise caution and, quote, use the buddy system when venturing out onto the ice this time of year. In weather, a warm front moves into Wisconsin today with high temperatures reaching the mid-30s in the north and low 40s in the south. Freezing rain could pop up overnight as well. Still warmer tomorrow with highs ranging from the low 40s in the north to low 50s in the south. A wintry mix is expected in the north. Rain is expected in the south as well. Lingering precipitation starts to clear up on Friday, but winds continue near 30 miles per hour. Daytime highs in the low 30s in the north and 40s in the south. On New Year's Eve Saturday, highs in the 30s in the north and 40s in the south once again. Scattered showers are possible across Wisconsin as well. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized weight loss program based in psychology for helping people change their habits and conquer their goals. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Washington. We turn to two states now that are making changes to law enforcement practices. On January 1st, Illinois will become the first state in the nation to end the cash bail system completely. As Mawa Iqbal from member station WBEZ reports, the state's Pretrial Fairness Act is part of a sweeping criminal justice reform package facing fierce Republican opposition.
If a defendant is facing a lower-level, nonviolent charge, they will no longer have to pay a cash bail to be released from jail while they await trial. But a judge can still hold the defendant if they prove to be a flight risk or a danger to the community. Governor J.B. Pritzker says this reform is for the single mom who commits shoplifting, but is stuck in jail because she can't afford her way out.
The changes that will be brought about by this new law will bring more justice and more fairness to many who have so often been forgotten.
Other states have come close, like California, where efforts to pass similar legislation have been stalled, with fierce opposition coming from the bail bonding industry. And advocates in Illinois were prepared for a fight here, too.
Show me what community looks like!
At a rally earlier this year inside the state Capitol Rotunda, Brianna Payton of the Chicago Community Bond Fund said they're determined to see the act over the finish line.
There's been a lot of hatred. A lot of hatred targeted towards people that are getting out of jail as though they're not members of our communities. And we need to stand for people to have the presumption of innocence.
The battle began when the bill was signed into law last year. Republican lawmakers called the act dangerous, saying it will open the door for violent criminals to be let out onto the streets. It became the hot-button issue for conservative candidates during the midterms in November. They were calling it the Purge Law, likening it to the horror movie The Purge, where all crime is allowed for a 12-hour period once a year. Legal experts, however, pointed out the act outlines dozens of, quote, forcible felonies that a person can still be denied pretrial release for, like murder and armed robbery. But Republican elected officials continue to push back. During a winter legislative session, Democratic lawmakers introduced changes to the original act, addressing some of their concerns. But House Minority Leader Jim Durkin said Republican input was largely ignored.
I had to find out through the state's attorneys who were involved with these of when the next meeting was and what happened at the meetings.
And while many state attorneys had seats at the negotiating table, over 60 of them from all over Illinois are suing Governor Pritzker and top Democratic lawmakers. They're arguing the elimination of cash bail is unconstitutional. Their attorney, James Rowe, said during oral arguments, the law should have been decided by voters.
The Constitution is not a grant of powers to the legislature. It is a limitation on the legislature's power.
The judge plans to hand down a decision before January 1st. In the meantime, courtrooms and sheriff departments are moving forward with preparations for the big change. Julia Reitz, a state attorney from Central Illinois, says she and other prosecutors have been attending trainings hosted by the state Supreme Court.
That is something that we are going to keep an eye on and look at as we move forward as to how that affects our ability to ensure the safety of our communities.
The High Court has also been hosting a series of virtual town halls aimed at explaining the nuts and bolts of the new system. And the Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice is training volunteers to court watch as judges, state's attorneys, and defendants navigate this historic change. For NPR News, I'm Mawa Iqbal in Springfield, Illinois.
Moving on to New York City, where 50 years ago, a police officer was ahead of his time. Our law enforcement correspondent Martin Costi recently discovered a podcast produced by the city's police department about the history of hostage negotiations.
As I've covered police reform over the last few years, one of the mantras has been time. Cops are now being told to slow things down during confrontations, to make room for de-escalation. It's 21st century thinking, which is why it was so surprising to hear this voice from the past.
The common element in all these situations is time, T-I-M-E, time.
This is a training film made almost five decades ago. The man speaking is the late Harvey Schlossberg. He was a New York City cop, but he was one who also happened to have a psychology degree. So the brass had him devise a strategy for dealing with a very specific kind of problem, an armed suspect who takes hostages.
This man goes into a situation to commit a crime. He gets caught in the act and he panics. What we count on is if we can give that panic feeling a chance to pass, he may realize that escaping or killing the hostage may not be the only way to handle the situation.
This seems eminently reasonable today, but in the early 70s it was revolutionary, says Edward Conlon. He's a retired NYPD officer as well as the writer and host of the podcast about this history, which is called Talk to Me.
Yeah, hostage negotiations, which was born out of a chief here just watching the Olympics in 1972 and seeing how badly it was handled.
He's referring there to the Israelis who were killed at Munich when terrorists took them hostage and the West German police tried to rescue them.
And realizing that no police department anywhere ever had a programmatic approach to hostage crises.
And in 1970s New York, armed standoffs were a real problem. Conlon's podcast has the voices of the people involved as the NYPD tried out its new talk strategy. It has officers, hostages, and it has this.
Are you able to hear anything now?
I hear you. I got a radio here, yeah.
I was doing Dylan right now because you said you wanted Dylan. I did.
A hostage taker on the radio. This is tape from one of the upcoming podcast episodes telling the story of a failed bank robber named Cat who took hostages in a bank, then got on the phone with a local rock station. What's striking is that while Cat fully expects the police to shoot him at the first opportunity, the DJ seems to mirror the NYPD's new, more patient philosophy.
They've got great marksmen out there, probably, you know, if I stick my head up, you know.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to take a pot shot at anybody. I don't think you do, and I don't think they do.
I'm not a killer, you know.
Keep in mind that the police were listening to the radio, too, and biting their tongues. Edward Conlon again.
You really have to swallow a lot of pride, and you have to keep focused on the mission, which is saving lives.
Eventually, this philosophy caught on. The NYPD's team traveled around the country teaching other departments how to do hostage negotiations. But later, things were complicated by the rise of active shooters. After Columbine, police had to learn to distinguish between people who take hostages and people who just want to kill. Still, Chuck Wexler, the director of the Police Executive Research Forum, says the 50-year-old insights of cop psychologist Harvey Schlossberg still matter.
Today, they're as relevant, if not more, about communication, slowing things down, and using time and distance. Valuable lessons in the 70s, they're as relevant today, if not more so.
For anyone really interested in how those ideas evolved, the podcast Talk to Me is planning a total of 27 episodes, available on most podcast platforms. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Alex Crow on Morning Edition. Good morning. It's 8:42. You can make WPR part of your holiday plans this year. We'll bring you some great holiday specials on New Year's Day. That includes Wisconsin Classical, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. That will be at 12:30 in the afternoon. You can learn more about all of our specials at wpr.org/holidays. That's wpr.org/holidays.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's more than a century of information, connection, and inspiration for the people of Wisconsin. When you give, you ensure that WPR's bright future includes plenty of in-depth news, world-class music, and thought-provoking discussions and entertainment. Thank you for supporting the important role of WPR in your community with your year-end gift right now at wpr.org/donate.
Support for WPR comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, with hats and headwear global to local, with Stormy Cromer hats and diverse headwear from around the world, through February 26th, lywam.org.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who would like to have newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or call 564-3744.
We're on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a look at what's happening in news today. Thousands more flights canceled across the country today as Southwest Airlines releases a public apology. Lots of those flights, at least 30, happening at Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. The Supreme Court of the United States has ruled 5-4 that Title 42 must stay in place, Neil Gorsuch joining all liberals in dissenting. Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt is warning people to be careful near ice. This after a 29-year-old man was found dead in a river yesterday afternoon. And Governor Tony Evers is tapping Sheboygan County Administrator Adam Payne to become the next head of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Today, a warm front moves in, raising temperatures across the state. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mattress Firm, dedicated to providing personalized service with the goal of helping people sleep well so they can live well. Customers can shop their range of products in-store or online at mattressfirm.com. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. This is NPR.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a bipartisan group of political observers in La Crosse, which has been wagering on the outcome of elections for nearly 50 years.
At Houghton's Restaurant near Viterbo University in La Crosse, a group of seven people gather around a table filled with Friday fish fry specials and pints of beer. This is a group of one-time political heavy hitters from the La Crosse area. They gather around election time each year to talk politics and bet on the outcome of elections. The current group includes a former Republican state Senate president and a Democrat who was a former president of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents.
I have been the absolute loser. I have been the absolute winner. And I believe that today I'm one of the absolute winners.
Walter Baltz of West Salem has been a longtime supporter of Republican candidates. He's also the only living founder of this little-known group, which calls itself the Select Committee on Election Predictions. Baltz used to have lunch in La Crosse in the late 1970s with a radio personality and a doctor. The conversation would often turn to politics.
And we'd argue as to who was going to be the winner of the upcoming elections. And I finally got tired of so much baloney, and I said, the only way to get people to be honest about this is to put some money on it.
The Select Committee has operated largely in obscurity over the years. The only mention of the group was in a New York Times article on the 1988 presidential election. While Baltz can't pinpoint when the group started, the Times article says it was in 1978. Few rules govern the wagering the Select Committee does, except that they place bets at least twice a year during the April and November general elections.
Anyone who was not a winner but was not the absolute loser, each one of those people would have to pay $5 to the absolute winner. The absolute loser had to buy lunch for everyone at the next event.
Dick Record, what are you doing on the congressional race?
On this particular morning, it's the Friday before the November general election, and the group is picking winners in the statewide and local races.
It's Brad Path and Ben Orton.
One. Key national elections, like the U.S. Senate races in Georgia and Pennsylvania, are also on the ballot in case there's a tie. University of Wisconsin La Crosse Emeritus Political Scientist Joe Heim has been a voting member and the Select Committee's record keeper since the 1980s.
I think all of us enjoy the camaraderie and the political discussions. I think we all respect each other. We come from all sorts of different backgrounds, but we all seem to have contact with our political circles and political activities.
Former La Crosse mayor and longtime Democratic state representative John Mettinger has been a winner and a loser in the 20 years he's been part of the group. He says politics might be better today if people with different ideas sat down and talked with each other, like the Select Committee does.
With this group, we're here to be honest, and that's why sometimes when we go down the list of people running for office, we wind up picking people that we don't like at all, but we figure that they're going to win.
Walter Baltz says when the group started, there were just three members. The loser used to have to pay for lavish meals, including caviar, steaks, and champagne. Now, the loser pays for fish fry and beer. These days, there are 8 members, and the group will consider adding new members, including its first woman. WPR's John Davis wrote and produced this story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Free classes on improving your health and well-being for caregivers and persons living with diabetes are offered in English and Spanish. Learn more today. Call 262-605-6646.
WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly fun. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:50. In sports, the Wisconsin Badgers football team ended the season with a win in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl. They beat Oklahoma State 24-17 last night. The Badgers women's basketball team will be taking on Illinois tomorrow night. The men's team will play on Friday. And the Milwaukee Bucks take on the Chicago Bulls tonight. That'll wrap up a holiday road trip for the Bucks. That one is set to tip off at 7. In weather, a warm front moves in across Wisconsin today. High temperatures reaching the mid-30s in the north and upper 30s to low 40s in the south. Freezing rain is expected to pop up overnight. Temperatures rising tomorrow, 40s in the north and 50 degrees in the south. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faudel.
And I'm A. Martinez. In the graphic novel New Kid, writer and cartoonist Jerry Kraft tells the story of black seventh grader Jordan Banks. He's the new kid, finding his way at an elite private school that's predominantly white. New Kid has received numerous honors. It has also been challenged in a Texas school district with a parent complaining that the content promotes critical race theory, or, in other words, calls out institutional racism. Kraft hopes readers see themselves in his books, New Kid and Class Act. And he told me that his character, Jordan Banks, is partly based on himself.
He loves, loves, loves to draw, as did I. He wanted to go to art school, as did I. His mom and dad didn't want him to go to art school because the only term that they had ever heard, like my parents, with artists was starving artists. So they sent him to the prestigious Riverdale Academy Day School, where they think that he can get an education, get a real job, and not, you know, be a cartoonist when he grows up, which was my parents' hope. You know, sorry I disappointed them. but you know, he has a very innocent view of the world.
Yeah, and in the book, Jordan pretty much experiences all the stereotypes that I think some kids really do. I mean, there's he's being asked what sport he plays. A girl saying that new kid is kind of cool, yet so non-threatening. I mean, that's some pretty intense stuff for a 12-year-old to deal with.
Well, you know, it is, but it isn't. Because what I wanted to do, like, in my opinion, a lot of the books with African-American protagonists have some, like, there's this really big thing that happens. You know, a life-changing event, you know, catastrophic. And, you know, death or police or someone goes to jail or drugs. And I didn't want to show that. So there is no catastrophe in New Kid, but it's just kind of the day-to-day code switching. And you get so used to it, you know, just having someone call you the wrong name or, you know, touch your hair. It's not catastrophic by nature. It's annoying. You know, but so, like I said, I really did want to have a book where you could read it and relax and just kind of subtly point out things that, you know, we can all do to improve how these kids grow up.
So in place of that tragic, catastrophic event that changes someone from that day forward, these little things that sometimes maybe a kid like Jordan at 12 years old maybe doesn't quite understand, or maybe does understand, but those are these kind of things that build up and add up and shape the adult that some kids like Jordan become.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you're sitting around a group of kids and they are talking about, you know, the TV shows they watch or the music that they listen to, and you're kind of always on the outside, or, you know, when they learn their first racist jokes from their parents and they're like, hey, you know, Jerry, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, and then they all laugh. And it's like, yeah, that's not really funny. And they think that they're joking. But when you hear that over and over and over again, by the time you're in your 30s or your 40s, if you don't have things that can counteract that, you know, you're trained in a lot of ways to be a second-class citizen. You know, even taking my sons to the movies, whereas, you know, their white counterparts, if they wanted to see someone that looked like them, their parents took them to see Harry Potter and, you know, Percy Jackson, and, you know, our versions was 12 Years a Slave and Harriet Tubman, and you know what I mean? Like, there just aren't a lot of happy stories. You have no aspirations. And I have a teacher who emailed me, and, you know, all the kids were going around saying what they wanted to do when they grow up. And the black kid in the class goes, well, if I live to be 18, I hope to do blah, blah, blah.
If I live to be 18.
If I live to be 18, right. So I wanted to have a book where there is hope.
Yeah, I mean, so New Kid and Class Act, they just sound like coming of age stories. I mean, it's you know, you're writing about a lot of the experiences that you had as a kid, but that's what it basically comes down to. Now, you know, Jordan Banks is a very specific kid, and these are his specific experiences. But, you know, I want to know, Jerry, like, what was your understanding then about what caused people to call for the banning of your book? What was there a specific example in the book? Anything like they could point to say that's why it should be banned?
No, because when I heard that it was banned, I tried to research it, and I found that it was being banned because it teaches critical race theory. So my first step was to Google critical race theory, because
wait, at
the time
you didn't know what
it was. I had no idea what it was. And then they start lobbing terms like Marxism. And I'm like, how is it Marxism? You know, they get these terms and they've not even read the book, because when they pulled it from the school system in Katy, Texas, they did a review, and then the adults who actually read the book, they were like, there was nothing wrong with this, you know, but they had already canceled my school visit, and they took the books off the shelf. And when they read it, they immediately put it back on the shelves. They apologized and they said, we would love it if you would, you know, reschedule your school visit, which I did, because at the end of the day, it's the kids, you know, who'd be missing out.
Once the book was banned, then it was reviewed, then it was not banned, and you went through all of these ups and downs of being criticized for things that maybe weren't really in the book. I'm wondering if at all you as a writer maybe took a step back to kind of analyze your writing or your approach to telling stories. Did any of that maybe change anything in your process?
Well, you know, I did think about it, and at the end of the day, I realized that if I started to censor myself, then they've won. Like, this is what they wanted me to do, is to not have these books where kids of color are just equal to their white counterparts. You know, that was all I wanted to do. So now in a school trip where everyone goes to Paris, all the kids are the New Kids. So they're equally uncomfortable because they don't speak the language. And so, you know, there are things that I did specifically put in to talk about book banning, because I'm not going to shy away from it.
That's the author Jerry Kraft. His next graphic novel, School Trip, comes out in April. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Alex Crow. You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear it from 5 to 9 here each weekday. News is next, then Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins.
Support for WPR comes from more than 50,000 contributors, including many monthly sustainers. You provide access to quality journalism, community conversations, and refreshing entertainment around Wisconsin and on WPR.org. Thank you for your support.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public.